Hello again, everyone, and welcome to another edition of KHOI Community Radio's Capital Week, your window on the world of Iowa politics, where we explore and analyze who's been making news in and around the state capitol, what that news is, and what it all means. I'm Dennis Hart, joined as always by my partner in politics, Laura Bellin of the blog site Bleeding Heartland. Welcome, Laura.
Good evening, Dennis.
As usual, Laura, during this frenetic legislative session, we have plenty to talk about on this broadcast, including Governor Reynolds' plans for even more future tax cuts, that's right, more of them, and lawmakers approving caps on medical malpractice bills. But we're going to start tonight with the governor signing into law a new public school funding bill, the biggest hike in years, but still not nearly enough for state Democrats and education advocates. Laura, take it from there.
Yes. So the in education, K through 12 education, they have a state supplemental aid bill every year that increases or sets the amount of per pupil funding. So the districts get money based on their enrollment, and they increase this per pupil funding by 3%. That is the largest increase since 2015, but it is significantly below the rate of inflation. And for about the last 10 or 12 years, every year that the legislature has increased the supplemental state aid, it has been below the rate of cost increases for schools. And I want to emphasize that this is per pupil funding. It does not mean that every school district receives 3% more than they received last year. A lot of school districts actually will receive less money because they have lower enrollment next year than this year, and they'll get less money from the state, even though per pupil they'll be getting 3% more.
So the new bill is going to bring total new spending to about $107 million a year, or about $7,635 for each student. That's almost precisely the same amount it is that the governor's education savings account bills, public money for private schools, is going to cost.
And I think that that's not a coincidence. The governor came out during her condition of the state speech, and she suggested in her budget 2.5% increase. The Senate Republicans initially were suggesting a 2% increase in per pupil aid, but the House Republicans prevailed on this. And I think it's because they did not want to increase spending on K through 12 public schools by a smaller amount than what they were spending on this new school voucher program. So that's why the amounts are going to be similar. Of course, in subsequent years, the school voucher costs are going to escalate significantly to more than $300 million a year, but the per pupil funding increase is not likely to be nearly as large over the next few years.
Almost every Democrat in both the House and the state Senate voted against the increase. They wanted it to be nearly 6%, and they had no chance.
Right. I mean, they picked this number. Obviously, it was a pie in the sky number. It's been well over a decade since the legislature has increased per pupil funding by 6%. Actually, if you go back and look at the history of school funding going back to the 1970s, when they started this funding program, the formula, there were a number of years during the 70s and 80s that they were increasing school funding by 6% or more, but that hasn't happened for a very long time.
While this was happening last week, a House subcommittee advanced a bill loosening testing requirements for those students who will take advantage of the governor's private school funding program.
Yes, well, and it was interesting because during the debate on the voucher bill, some of the Democrats said these private schools are not going to be accountable. And this was a point that the Republican floor managers raised. So they'll be accountable because they'll still be subject to the testing. But already the House Minority Leader Jennifer Confers was saying last week, we told you so, that it's only been a few weeks since the governor signed the voucher bill and they're already loosening these requirements. Now, advancing a bill out of a subcommittee is a long way from making it law. So I haven't heard the governor say that she definitely wants to eliminate testing requirements for private schools. So we'll see whether this bill goes anywhere.
And on the very same day last week that the governor signed the public school funding bill into law, Des Moines public school district officials announced they could close buildings as part of next year's budget because they're going to have a problem.
Yes, and the Des Moines Public Schools are by far the largest school district in the state with about 30,000 students, but they are having declining enrollment, and they may end up having enrollment fall even further once more families are able to get state funding to send their children to private schools. So it's not clear, but there are a number of other school districts around the state that are looking at ways to cut their budgets, again, because of the same issue. Even with the 3% increase in per pupil funding, the total amount of money they're going to get from the state next year will be lower, because they will have fewer students enrolled in their K through 12 education.
If it seems as if we're talking a lot about education these last few broadcasts, it's because that's one of the major, really major issues going on in the state legislature. So many moving parts. And one of them last week is that five Iowa moms, all members of a group, made their case to lawmakers last Monday night to remove or eliminate inappropriate books in schools. This is the Moms for Liberty group.
Yes, and this is interesting. The House Government Oversight Committee in recent years hasn't been very active. And when they have had meetings, many of them have been related to education. If anyone remembers last year, there was a very long oversight committee hearing that was entirely devoted to the Ames School District and berating the administrators over a curriculum that was used during Black History Month, a Black Lives Matter curriculum. So, I mean, the oversight committee has been quite preoccupied with education policy as opposed to many other areas of government that they could be looking at. And this hearing was also a bit odd because at most legislative hearings, they alternate speakers for or against whatever's being proposed. This hearing was just for invited speakers only. And again, all five speakers from this Moms for Liberty organization were asking for the same thing. Representatives of school districts, libraries, other parents who disagree with the Moms for Liberty goals, they were not invited to speak.
Now, another one of these moving parts took place last week when a Senate Education Subcommittee, again, recommended passage of a bill by a Republican senator that would ban LGBTQ topics from being taught in schools in Iowa K through 8th grade.
Yeah, so there have been several bills like this. There was one earlier that passed out of a subcommittee that would have just banned curriculum on gender identity. This one would be sexual orientation and gender identity. It's similar to a proposal that the governor has now signed on to. And again, I watched this subcommittee. This was a little bit of a raucous subcommittee. Again, they were alternating speakers. And some of the speakers were saying, well, what's your definition of curriculum involving sexual orientation? Because if you have a teacher named Mrs. Smith, I mean, you might argue that that's already introducing some kind of an idea about somebody's sexual orientation. If a teacher casually refers to their spouse, their husband, or their wife, that could already be introducing, or even when the teacher says boys or girls, it's time for recess, that could be introducing the idea of a gender identity. So, I mean, it was, I mean, there were people feel emotions are running high during these subcommittees on these education bills.
And here's another moving part. If this seems confusing, we're going to try to really clear it up here. While all of this was going on last week, the governor unveiled her new education bill. Yes, that is separate from what else is happening here, although there's some overlap. The bill in general is going to set new standards for what students can and cannot learn and establish more control for parents. And let's get into some of the details on this one.
Yeah, so the introduction of the bill says that it is about establishing, giving parents and guardians more control over their own children's education. Although, if you look at the terms of the bill, in some ways it's giving certain parents more control over other children's education. This was part of this stemmed from remarks that the governor made at this town hall in Des Moines a couple of weeks ago that was hosted by Moms for Liberty, where she proposed limiting from grades kindergarten through three any instruction related to gender identity or sexual orientation. She also said that she wanted to introduce something that said that if one school district removed a book from the library, that in all other school districts in Iowa, it would be on a restricted list where the library could only make it available with written consent from the student's parents. That would be a pretty big step for the State Department of Education to take that kind of control over from school districts. And then the couple of pieces that were new when this bill dropped, one would require a high school students to take a citizenship test, which I don't think is going to be very controversial. But the other one was removing from the curriculum from 7th through 12th grade any instruction related to HIV or HPV, the papillomavirus, and the availability of a vaccine to prevent HPV. And that was a big surprise to people when the bill dropped.
So, if all of this sounds like a lot going on in education, it's now being recognized by, in some quarters across the nation, that Iowa is really in the center of this effort, among states, individual states, to take control, give parents more control over schools, and to banish such topics as LGBTQ, gender identity, et cetera, et cetera. In fact, Rekha Bazu, the former columnist for the Des Moines Register, had a piece on this in yesterday's Los Angeles Times, of all places, this very thing going on. Iowa really taking the lead in this, isn't it?
Well, I think that you can argue that Virginia took the lead. This was perceived as an issue that helped Glenn Youngkin become elected governor of Virginia, the first Republican governor there in a while. And so the Iowa Republicans during last year started following that template, and the governor is continuing to follow that template. But I think that this HPV vaccine thing, to me, that was a tell that this Moms for Liberty group is much more influential than I'd realized. There are other national groups that have been involved in the school choice debate in Iowa for quite a while, Americans for Prosperity being one of them, Informed Choice Iowa being one, but Moms for Liberty was a little bit new to me. And as one of these other subcommittees on a bill that would restrict the teaching of gender identity, one of the speakers did bring up this HPV vaccine information, and it kind of seemed like it was coming from nowhere. I mean, people were surprised after the subcommittee. I even asked the bill sponsor, and he said, yeah, he didn't know why she was bringing that up. But now it's clear that this is something that Moms for Liberty is pushing around the country, and then this provision ended up in the governor's bill.
Some are speculating that Governor Reynolds is using this as a possible base for a run, if you will, not for president necessarily, but a push to become the vice presidential candidate, depending upon who the GOP president is, the candidate. Do you see this as her push for a higher office, or is this just simply she's got the power now, she's always wanted to do this, let's do it?
I mean, that is a widely held view. I personally have never believed that she wants to hold any other office besides being governor for a long time. I think, like her mentor Terry Brand said, I think she may run for re-election quite a few more times. So I am not expecting her to be on a ticket. But in general, she has picked up, I mean, the first few years she was governor, she didn't express any particular interest in legislation targeting LGBTQ rights or equality or instruction. But I think that she has perceived now that this is something that in a certain segment of the Republican base, this is very popular. It's something people strongly believe in. She picked it up last year with the bill banning transgender girls from participating in school sports. And she got a very favorable reaction from that corner of the base. And so I think she's just pushing forward with that. Like I said, I am not a believer that she will end up on a ticket or even really aspires to be on a ticket. But I do think that she likes to be on these national programs. She likes to be interviewed on national conservative media. And as she likes to be perceived as pushing this part of the Republican agenda.
It is 12 after the hour, wherever you're listening to us. Yes, indeed. You're in tune with KHOI Radio's Capital Week, your one-stop source for everything political going on in Iowa. I'm Dennis Hart with Laura Bellin. And we are indeed here every week at this time to talk about politics, Iowa style, how it's affecting all of us. All right, let's move on from education to medical malpractice damages. A big breakthrough last week in Iowa on one of the big issues she's pushing besides education, and that is tort reform. And she got a lot of it last week.
Wow, this was a big deal. This was one of the most interesting legislative debates I've ever seen, honestly. This is a bill that the House Republicans blocked 2 years in a row. There were attempts even before the last couple of years, but there was more pressure from leadership in 2021 and two over this. They didn't get it through the vote on the floor. And now with these super majorities that they have in the House and Senate, they were able to get it through. But I have never seen so many Republicans speak against a Republican bill during legislative debate. I have never seen so many Republicans vote against a priority bill for leadership, including some serving their first term in the legislature. And it was just fascinating to watch. And I don't know what, I am skeptical that they'll be able to push the second big leg of this tort reform, which is the trucking industry immunity bill, but they sure got a big win for the insurance companies and the Iowa medical lobby with this medical malpractice changes.
And the legislation that passed last week limits non-economic damages to $2 million in medical malpractice lawsuits against hospitals and $1 million in lawsuits against clinics and individual doctors. And as you say, some of those Republicans who stood up to speak against it cast it in extremely personal and emotional terms.
And I want to just briefly explain what economic damages and non-economic damages are. So economic damages are things like lost future earnings because you're unable to work, or it could be for a child who is going to be unable to work for their whole life, or the cost of caring for someone that someone is going to need that kind of long-term care. And the bill actually expands the definition of economic damages. So for instance, if a stay-at-home parent of a young child or somebody who's a full-time caregiver to a person with disabilities employees is a victim of medical malpractice, then the cost of replacing that person's care, that can also now be considered economic damages. Non-economic damages are what are commonly called pain and suffering. And usually in a case involving medical negligence, there might be your lost future earnings. But as one of the lobbyists said during the subcommittee on this bill, I'm more than my job, right? I mean, if I lose the ability to enjoy life and my quality of life, I'm in constant pain, unable to move. Those are all things that non-economic damages in a few cases have led to these very large jury awards. And so that's what this bill is really targeting. And I saw that the bill's floor managers were saying, hey, well, we're not limiting punitive damages at all, but punitive damages are extremely rarely awarded in a medical malpractice case because a medical negligence is something, I mean, doctors are very rarely acting with any kind of malice, right? I mean, nobody is intending to cause a catastrophic medical error. So that's why the non-economic damages, they don't assume any ill intent by the doctor or by the facility, which is where you would, to prove punitive damages, you would need to show that they intentionally caused harm.
The House voted 53-47 to pass the measure, 12 Republicans joining most Democrats in opposing it, Senate 29-20 in favor of it, 5 Republicans joining every Democrat in opposition. And as you say, that's a large number of Republican opponents.
It was a really big mix. And I will say, it actually, one of the Republicans who opposed the bill accidentally pushed the yes button. So he had to say later, like, oh, no, I meant to vote no. He put a note in the journal. So there were, and they were a wide range. I mean, everything from some long-serving members to several people just in their first term. And one of the things that I thought was most interesting about this debate was that there were, so 12 House Republicans and 5 Senate Republicans opposed this medical malpractice bill. And if you remember when we talked about the school voucher plan, there were 9 House Republicans and 3 Senate Republicans who voted against that. And there was almost no overlap. One member of the Iowa House, Brian Losey, voted against both bills. Otherwise, you're talking about completely different constellations of Republican legislators who were willing to defy leadership on high priority bills. And like I said, it just doesn't happen in the legislature. Or, I mean, occasionally there might be a small faction of people who oppose several aspects of the leadership agenda, but to have a 10 or 12 people who, again, aren't in some kind of a consistent block, just independently deciding to oppose this bill, I mean, it was very, very striking.
Let's move on to another topic that almost got no attention last week, but it's a big deal. Governor Reynolds went to Washington, D.C., and she spoke to a libertarian small government think tank called the Cato Institute, pretty well known in right-wing conservative politics. And she said, and again, this got almost no press, that she wants to completely eliminate Iowa's personal income tax before the end of her term in 2026. That's amazing because, you know, the state has just passed a law recently. We're on a flat tax now, and we're going down to 3.9% in a few years. Now she wants to get rid of all of it.
Well, and yes, and it was going to take a few years, so it would be 2025 or 2026 before we would even be down to that flat tax of 3.9% for all personal income tax filers in Iowa. So this was a big surprise for people. It's not something she's proposed in the past. When the Senate was debating the previous year's tax bill, there was, I remember a couple of senators saying, well, eventually we'd love to get rid of the income tax, but this is what we can afford to do right now. And I don't recall the governor ever saying that she was definitely on board with eliminating the income tax. Of course, she did say it in a setting in a national forum when there weren't any Iowa journalists around. I think many Iowa reporters would have a lot of questions about this, but the governor hasn't held a press conference since last July. So we have been unable to ask her about it. But I mean, the big question is, where's the money going to come from to fund state government? Because most of the states that have no income tax have major, major tourism industries like Nevada or Florida, or they have major extraction industries like Alaska and Wyoming, where oil or minerals are such a big part of the economy. So I'm just not sure how the budget could even be balanced with no personal income tax. I mean, I just don't know whether there are plans that the governor has already started to develop or whether this was just something she said off the cuff at this event in Washington.
It's estimated that if it were in effect right now, the no income tax, it would cost about $4.5 billion in revenue for the state. Of course, that would be in tax savings for Iowans. But where does the money come from to fund anything in Iowa if you keep cutting back billions of dollars?
Yeah, I mean, the whole state budget is around $9 billion. So, I mean, this would be a very significant, I just don't know. I don't know exactly what you could cut because education and Medicaid are such a big part of the state budget. I mean, you can't just cut the budget in half. I mean, even if you completely eliminated some state government agencies like the Department of Natural Resources or something, I mean, you still wouldn't come anywhere close to saving $4 billion in revenue. I mean, it just does. So, like I said, a lot of questions. I mean, it could be that she has a plan to greatly increase the sales tax. And I don't know. I mean, or somehow increase property taxes or levy some other kind of a new tax to recoup part of the revenue. I think there might be quite a bit of resistance to that in the legislature, though.
I'm thinking we're going to be following all of this on Capitol Week over the next weeks, months, years, who knows. All right. Laura Bellin, along with state lawmakers, you are all poring over Governor Reynolds' 1,500-page bill aimed at overhauling the structure of state government. No, we do not want a full critique tonight. We started that last week. But there's one thing you're focusing on, and some people are making noise about, deservedly so, and those are the parents and staff of the Iowa School for the Deaf in Council Bluffs.
Yes, I mean, there are so many pieces of this bill, and the Iowa Senate just had another subcommittee today that dealt with about 10 different subdivisions. But two that have really aroused a lot of concern are moving this, the Iowa School for the Deaf, which is now, it's a K-12 school, but it is part of the Iowa Board of Regents, which is the governing body for the state universities. And the idea is that this would move into the State Department of Education, because that most of K-12 education is already run by the State Department of Education and local school districts. The biggest concern, though, about the bill is not just the moving to a different agency, but currently there's language in the state code that says if they want to close the school for the deaf, the legislature has to agree to that. And this would change it so that the governor could just unilaterally, the executive branch could unilaterally close the school for the deaf. And some other states have done this, but there's a lot of concern among advocates for the deaf in Iowa that it's very difficult for students who need instruction in ASL. It's difficult even with accommodations for them to really get the instruction that they need being mainstream in a regular school district. So that has aroused a lot of concern. During the subcommittee that I watched today, many representatives of the blind community spoke against a different part of the bill, which would change the Department of the Blind so that instead of the director being appointed by the Iowa Commission for the Blind, it would be an office appointed directly by the governor and a person serving at the pleasure of the governor. So the governor could fire that person at any time. And people were very concerned that you could have a political appointee who comes from the sighted community, who really doesn't understand the services that the Department of Blind offers and would not be accountable to the board, the Commission for the Blind, which is really made up of people who understand the services and in most cases have used the services themselves.
Let's briefly talk about one or two things that went on in the state Senate and state House last week. Just briefly, other things. Among them, Governor Reynolds and the state Senate came one step closer to controlling the majority of the votes in all of Iowa's judicial nominating commissions.
So this is some unfinished business from 2019. 4 years ago, the governor made a big play to completely reorganize the judicial nominating commissions that send candidates for judicial vacancies to the governor. Since 1962, Iowa did away with electing judges in 1962. We replaced it with this merit-based system where you have independent judicial nominating commissions made up half of elected lawyers, half of people appointed by the governor. A judge would sit as the chair of the commission, and then they recommend candidates, and the governor's appointee has to be one of the finalists this commission recommends. So in 2019, this was another bill. They couldn't get through what the governor wanted through the Iowa House, and they settled on a compromise that gave the governor one extra appointee on the state judicial nominating commission. That is the one that recommends candidates for the Iowa Supreme Court and the Iowa Court of Appeals, and then left the district level judicial nominating commissions, which recommend candidates for most of the judgeships in Iowa, left that untouched. So now this goes back, and this would replicate at the district level what already happened at the state judicial nominating commission level. So they would get rid of the judge as the chair of the commission, and instead of having equal numbers of elected attorneys and governor's appointees, the governor would get one extra vote. And the idea is then her appointees would have a better chance of getting her the finalist she really wants to appoint to these judgeships. So the Democrats, this debate happened very soon after they passed the medical malpractice bill. And even though there was quite a bit of fatigue from hours of debate on the medical malpractice bill, quite a few Democrats did get up and speak against this judicial nominations bill. And they said, just basically, this is a power grab by the governor. The floor manager said, we're just trying to do what we've already done for the state commission, and it's working pretty well.
And briefly, in the state house last week, GOP House Member Luana Stoltenberg of Davenport threw a bombshell up. She says she hopes Iowa is going to pass a life at conception bill. The governor is not talking about this. I know of nobody else talking about it. What was this?
Well, I mean, there have been every year since I've been following the legislature, there are always some Republicans who file what's called a personhood bill. And usually it doesn't go anywhere, even under the Republican trifecta, because the Republican leadership up to now has shown no interest in this. And I don't think that this bill that a first term Republican is introducing is going to go anywhere. I think what is potentially more significant on the abortion front in Iowa is that Iowa's Attorney General Brenna Byrd last week signed on to a legal brief with about 20 other Republican attorneys general in a Texas case that could lead to the main medication used for medication abortions and miscarriage care. It could lead to the FDA approval of that drug being revoked. So, I mean, that is something that is more likely to directly affect abortion in Iowa than what Luana Stoltenberg wants to introduce that probably isn't going to even make it out of committee.
And very briefly, before we move on to the State of the Union, someone joined a Zoom call during a Senate subcommittee meeting last week while displaying a swastika. Lawmakers ended that Zoom call, and now Zoom may never come back.
Yeah, well, I was watching that subcommittee, and I was quite annoyed because they cut off the Zoom, so then I couldn't see the closing comments by the legislators. They are still, for now, using Zoom, but they're not allowing any speakers to participate on Zoom. And that was an issue during today's subcommittee on the state government reorganization bill, because there were speakers on the Zoom who wanted to give public comments and they were not called on. And so they said today, I asked about this, I asked the staff prior to the meeting, and they said for now, they're still using Zoom so that people from outside the Des Moines area can watch. But for now, they're not letting people speak at the subcommittees, and they don't know whether that will continue. I haven't heard of any more disruptions this week. That happened to be during the bill on the subcommittee that would relax the child labor rules. And so that was a very controversial bill. And in any case, these disruptions, I don't think there has been another one so far this week.
And briefly, we're not going to go over President Biden's second State of the Union address last week. He made it. We will go over just briefly Republican response in Iowa. Totally negative. The governor issued a statement after Biden's speech saying the administration, I'm quoting now, has lost every sense of reality. And it was similar all down the line.
Right. And I mean, generally, I thought it was interesting that the governor, I mean, clearly, the Arkansas governor, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, gave the response this year. Governor Kim Reynolds gave the response last year. There was a lot of mutual admiration going back and forth. I thought it was interesting. A couple of the Republicans in Congress, Randy Feenstra and Ashley Hinson, were objecting that the president didn't say enough about agriculture and farmers. I mean, I went back and looked through several years' State of the Union addresses. That just hasn't been a topic that's been a major feature in any State of the Union for a long time. It just doesn't tend to be the focal point of the president's agenda. Of course, this year, Congress is going to be crafting a new farm bill. So I understand why members of Congress are very concerned about it. But the political ritual of the State of the Union is matched by the political ritual of members of the opposing party criticizing whatever the president said.
Absolutely. And very briefly, 1 minute here, former Arizona GOP gubernatorial candidate Carrie Lake, who lost the election in November but has never conceded, came to Iowa, and she may be running for something, Senate in Arizona. Maybe she wants to be VP under Donald Trump. She came in full of election denialism, and it worked on the Republicans who were there.
Yeah, and it was a full house in Bettendorf. She comes from Scott County, not quite the Quad Cities, but near the Quad Cities. And then she had an event in Ankeny. The room was packed as well in Ankeny. And after the public event that some journalists attended, she then went to a private reception with some luminaries, including former governor and ambassador Terry Branstad. So she certainly was embraced by the Republican establishment in Iowa. I don't think that Governor Reynolds was there. I didn't see any mention of Governor Reynolds participating. But yes, I thought it was she said that in Bettendorf, she said that her dad told her before the election that if she loses, she needs to just shake her opponent's hand and walk away. And she said, well, I didn't lose. So that's why I'm not doing that. So, I mean, for the record, she lost by about 17,000 votes and 0.7%. So a close election, but not really a recount close election. And she is still pursuing litigation in Arizona, but so far, none of her litigation has been successful.
And Laura, in 15 seconds, what are you looking at this week?
Oh, there are so many subcommittees every day about related to education, LGBTQ, and this government reorganization. So I'm watching all of that.
Woo, this has been a show tonight because a lot's going on. It's the most frenetic legislative session I can remember in a while. Laura, you're going to be busy, and so am I, and we'll be back next week. How's that?
Yeah, it sounds good. They really are moving quickly on so many bills this year.
Amazing. We are out of time. You have been listening to Capital Week on KHOI Community Radio, your listening post indeed for politics, Iowa style. A reminder that the views and opinions expressed here did not necessarily reflect the opinions of KHOI or its staff. Laura and I will be back next week in this very same time slot, we promise, and we're going to talk about everything interesting, important, or entertaining about politics in Iowa. We hope you can join us. Until then, thank you so much for the privilege of your time. We appreciate it and we value it. Between now and next time, have a safe, happy, and healthy week.